Well, hello, and thank you for joining us. I'm Father Nick, your priest and pastor at the Fort Church of St. Martin's Parish. And with me again is the Reverend Dr. Ross Wright to discuss how did we get the New Testament, our Christian education series, and particularly to discuss what's known as the synoptic problem. And we recognize that's a jargon word, or jargon term, so we're going to unpack it for you. But the synoptic problem, Q, or the Q source, and the Didache, these might all be new words for you, but don't worry, stick with us, and we'll explain it. But before we do, Ross, how are you?
I'm doing great, and I'm delighted to be a part of this conversation. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's jump right in and just begin by maybe clarifying these jargon terms and these words that might be a little bit unfamiliar. Maybe I'll start with the term synoptic, and you can add in anything you want. The synoptic gospels are Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Those three gospels. Now, you, of course, you remember that in our New Testament, there's only four gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but three of them are lumped together as the synoptic gospels. And this is from the Greek, syn, S-Y-N, not S-I-N, or soon, means with or together. And then optic, that should be a word that's familiar to everybody. You know, this has to do with seeing or our eyes. So to talk about Matthew, Mark, and Luke as the synoptic gospels, it means at the very least that they can be seen together and that they seem to see together. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. Ross, did you want to add to that?
Yes, just to point out that the when we talk about the synoptic problem, we're talking about the fact that there's overlapping material in these three gospels. And you might want to think about it as columns where you can see things lined out. We'll show you an image in a little bit where you can several texts that allow us to do this. So it's the synopsis is seeing in parallel fashion the material that is shared by these three gospels, and also seeing where there are differences. I think it's a simple way to suggest what synopsis means and edge towards the synoptic problem.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. I mean, what happened was that in the history of the church and of the Christian faith, as these writings were being taken down for the first time, the autographs produced, and then put together, this thing that we have of a Bible that's one book that's all bound together, Genesis to the Apocalypse or Revelation, that's something that really doesn't start to happen until towards the end of antiquity, towards the beginning of the medieval church, to have all of these things bound together in a book in that way. Instead, sometimes scrolls, sometimes codices, a codex is essentially a proto-book, an early form of the book, that Christians would write on these. Sometimes they'd write on sheets of papyrus collected and or vellum collected into a codex or into a scroll. Sometimes they'd write over papyrus or vellum pages that already had writing on them. They often reused, called a palimpsest, when it's written on top of something that's had writing that's faded. Writing was expensive, copying was expensive, and so sometimes the books would be put together And what happened was, and we'll talk more about this as we talk about the development of the canon, but what happened was, you know, the books started to be collected, certain books started to be collected together. The letters of Paul would be collected together. The Gospels would be collected together. There's a scene in St. Augustine's Confessions, and I know I've mentioned this recently in some context, so it might have been in one of the other videos or maybe in a Zoom discussion or something totally other, but there's a scene in St. Augustine's Confessions when he is kind of has this moment of conversion, and he hears this voice saying, tole lege, pick up and read. And he's got a book, and he picks it up and he reads, and he just lets it kind of fall open to where he'd been reading, and he reads that passage, and he reads from Paul's letter to the Romans. You might think that he's got a Bible in his hand, but he doesn't. He's got a collection, a codex that's a collection of just Paul's letters. So it doesn't have anything else in it. What this means is that the church kind of developed a way of reading through the texts. You move from one text to the next, and especially within the liturgical life of the church, we still do this. For example, in the way that the lectionary works in our church now, we read through in what we call year A, we read through the gospel according to Matthew. And then the next year, which we label year B, we read through the gospel according to Mark. And then the next year, year C, we read through the gospel according to Luke in our lectionary, that is in our text that we read Sunday morning for worship. And then we come back around and start with Matthew again. And we've got John kind of sprinkled in there throughout all 3 years. But that way of reading really gets you to focus on the story that you're hearing at that moment. And Ross, what you were kind of alluding to is that in the in the 19th century, and even starting a little bit before that, in the 18th century, after the printing press had kind of risen to prominence, and it became much easier to mass produce things like Bibles and to print them in different ways, what scholars began to do is to set these texts next to each other. So instead of reading through Matthew, and then you get to the end of Matthew, and then you start Mark, and you read through Mark, and then you get to the end of Mark, and you stop. Instead, they could set Matthew and Mark and Luke right next to each other. And in doing this, and looking kind of across the three, they could see where there were deep similarities and also profound differences. And those deep similarities were not just similarities in the kind of overall story that's being told or the kind of overall narrative and picture, but precise linguistic similarities. That is to say, the same unique Greek phrase might be used in Matthew and in Mark and in Luke in a particular place. And you think, you know, it's very unlikely that these three writers, if they're writing entirely independent of one another, would use the same exact Greek words, especially if the three of them, independent of each other, are thinking back or have heard a story about something Jesus said in the language that he spoke, which wasn't Greek, but was Aramaic. So, you know, if Ross is thinking back to something Jesus said in Aramaic, and I'm thinking back to something Jesus said in Aramaic, and Ross decides to translate that from Aramaic into Greek, and I decide to translate it from Aramaic into Greek, it's very unlikely that we're going to come up with the exact same Greek vocabulary and syntactic construction as one another. we're going to translate differently. I mean, that's just the nature of translation. And so when you see three different texts side by side, and they have the same vocabulary and they have the same grammar and syntax in a particular section, and they don't in other sections, you start to think they must have some kind of reliance on one another or on some other text that all three are referring back to. And that just is the synoptic problem. The question of why do these different texts have certain passages that are the same in Greek vocabulary, grammar, and syntax in some places and then not in others? Is that basically the way you see it, Ross?
Yeah, that's really a great explanation. And I thought I might just give a couple of examples. There's a place in the Gospels, all three Gospels, Synoptic Gospels, where there's a reaction to Jesus' teaching. People are amazed at Jesus' teaching. And each of the Gospels say this almost word for word the same. They were astonished at his teaching because he taught with authority. It's a simple phrase, simple construction. But if you think about it, why would they have described Jesus in exactly word for word the same way? It's theoretically possible that they might remember Jesus' actual words. If someone had a photographic memory, or not photographic memory, but if they had an audible memory, that, I mean, it's theoretically possible that the words could be so, remember in such detail that they would have chosen similar words, although I think Nick's point about the translation is important. But it would be very unusual for them to use exactly the same words to describe a person's actions or characterization. Another example of what makes us think that there's a literary relationship between these three Gospels or among them is that they also adopt the same sequence of events. And sometimes they'll adopt the same sequence of narrative events, even when it doesn't make particular logical sense. An example of this is the description of John the Baptist. There is a point in all three Synoptic Gospels where right in the middle of Jesus narrating Jesus's ministry, there's a pause and a flashback to the death of John the Baptist. And then the narrative picks up with Jesus' teaching. It's a very unusual pause. It doesn't make any particular logical sense. And so scholars look at this and they think, it's possible to think of one person coming up with this, but it would be very unusual for all three to do a flashback right in the middle of a narrative sequence that doesn't seem to make any particular reference to John the Baptist. So those are a couple of examples. And so the synoptic problem, simple way to put it, is scholars have looked for a way to explain both the similarities, but also the differences. Why are there differences? And how do we make sense of both similarities, you know, verbal correspondence on the one hand, but also significant differences?
Yeah, that's right. And so, and it's important to just kind of reiterate, this is true for Mark and Matthew and Luke. It's not so much true for John. It's not that John doesn't tell some of the same stories. He certainly does. It's not that John doesn't, have at his beginning the baptism of Jesus, which is the beginning of Jesus, you know, inaugurates Jesus's adult ministry in all of the Gospels, and of course ends with the crucifixion and resurrection. But in terms of narrative structure, that's about all that John shares with Matthew, Mark, and Luke. A good example of some of the differences, and we'll talk more about this when we get to John's gospel, but in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Jesus only goes to Jerusalem once in his adult life. He only goes there to be arrested and handed over and crucified. That's what happens when he goes to Jerusalem once in his adult life during his ministry. However, if you read John's gospel, Jesus is all the time going back and forth between Galilee, the Galilee and Judea, all the time making trips to Jerusalem. Another example is Matthew, Mark, and Luke, for example, will connect Jesus's what's known as the cleansing of the temple to the final week of Jesus's life. And it seems to be in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the event that really kind of gets him killed, basically. This is the event that puts him not just in the way of the Pharisees and the Sadducees, but also gets him, gets Roman interest in what he's doing. And it's after this event that those who wish to have him arrested and crucified begin to plot to find a way to do that, and they find Judas. So in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, this event of Jesus riding into Jerusalem on a donkey on Palm Sunday, and then cleansing the temple on the Monday or sometimes the Sunday evening, that's all within the last life of the last week of the life of Jesus. In John's gospel, that's one of the very first things Jesus does in his public ministry. At the very beginning of John's gospel, Jesus does that. So it just gives you a sense of how different the story is. John is not synoptic for that reason. He doesn't seem to share this overarching narrative or those specific Greek linguistic constructions and of sentences. So maybe we'll leave John aside and say, let's pick up on this idea of the narrative structure that all three of them share, because there's really three main hypotheses, three main ways of trying to explain this material that seems to be shared between Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Now, there's some other material we're going to get back to in a minute that's shared just between Matthew and Luke. But there's much more material that's shared between the three of them. And a big part of that is the narrative structure. Did you want to say anything about that, Ross?
Yes, just to sort of summarize what we've said so far and to clarify, the synoptic problem is claiming that one of the Gospels was written first and that the other two synoptic Gospels had the first Gospel to look at, as it were, spread out before them. Whether that was literally true or not, the point is that the two later Gospels were making use of the first Gospel. And as we'll explain in just a minute, there are two main theories about which one was written first, but we're talking about the literary relationship among these three synoptic gospels on the assumption that one was the lead gospel or was written first, and then the other two made use of it. Would this be a time to sort of jump into kind of the basic options or basic theories?
Yeah, I think so. Let me just say one thing real quick, which is that this shouldn't be a shock to anybody. This really shouldn't be a surprise that the Gospels have some sort of dependence upon one another as a source. We hear this actually in the Gospel of Luke itself, and in the very first chapter when Luke the author of the gospel, according to Luke, kind of lays out his little prologue. He says, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things which have been accomplished among us, just as they were delivered to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the truth concerning the things which you have been informed. This is Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. And then, in other words, what all Luke's saying there is, there's some other gospels out there besides this one that I've just written, and I consulted those, and I consulted some other sources, and tried to put things down as best I could. And that's basically what he's saying here. He's telling us that he has relied on some other gospel and some other source to write his gospel. So it's in scripture itself that there's this matter of literary dependence. So the real question is, which text has priority between the three? That is, which one was written first, and the other two are somehow dependent on it? And there's really kind of two main contenders, and one of them is Markan priority, that the Gospel of Mark was written first, and that plays out in two different hypotheses, which we'll talk about in a minute. And the other one is Matthean, or the Gospel of Matthew having priority, being the one written first, and that has its own hypothesis that goes along with it. Ross, did you want to start off with the possibility of the priority of Matthew?
Oh, you want me to start with Matthew? Sure. Let me lead into this by saying that the scholarly consensus these days is that Mark was probably written first, and we'll look at that in a second. But there have always been scholars and readers of the scriptures who believed that Matthew was written first. And it would have looked something like this, that Matthew's gospel was written first. Luke then was looking at Matthew, as it were, and taking a lot of the narrative structure and a lot of content as well from Matthew's gospel. But Luke also left some things out that Matthew included and added some things that Matthew doesn't have. That's a nice, yeah. Thank you, Nick. So you got Matthew is the source for Luke. And then the idea is that Mark, if it was written last, which is the theory with Matthean priority, at least in this model, is that Mark had both Matthew and Luke in front of him and wrote essentially an abbreviated version of the two, that he did a collation and shortened form. So he left out quite a bit of material that's in Matthew and Luke, though the narrative structure is largely intact.
All right, and this you'll see at the bottom of the screen in the share screen here, but for those who are listening and not able to see the what we have up on the screen, this is known as the Griesbach hypothesis, after a German scholar who put it forward, German New Testament scholar in the 19th century who made this argument. It actually predates Griesbach and the 19th century German biblical scholarship. St. Augustine of Hippo in the 4th century, not what we would call a modern biblical scholar, but someone who certainly thought about scriptures a lot and was at home in them and did have some kind of interest in how they came about and how they were put together. He also suggested that this is perhaps the way that it happened, that Matthew wrote first, that Luke used and changed Matthew, and that Mark took Matthew and Luke and kind of created what's sometimes called the Reader's Digest version of Matthew and Luke. Ross, there's some reasons why I find this to be problematic, and I imagine there are some for you also. What are some of the reasons that you're unconvinced by this one?
Yeah, there's several. One problem with the Griesbach hypothesis has to do with material that Mark decided not to include. If he was written last and he did this condensed version, it meant that he would have left out some really juicy parts of the gospel, like the Sermon on the Mount, which both Matthew and Luke include, the Lord's Prayer, which is not in Mark. Mark does not have any of the birth narratives. And so people who have raised questions about the Griesbach hypothesis have done so partially on the grounds that it seems highly implausible that Mark would have left out this material that seems so important to the life of Jesus. So that's one of the reasons why they're questions. Another question, this is a little more technical, but some of the material that Matthew and Luke share but is not shared by Mark. Actually, let me start this over again. Mark has some material that's not in Matthew and Luke, but it tends to be material that's either narratively or theologically complicated. I won't go through all the details, but there's some tricky passages, things that are not sort of obvious or don't make a whole lot of sense. There's some unusual vocabulary. There's some things that just don't lie easily on the page, so to speak. And it doesn't mean that they're not true, but it raises the question, why would Mark have added material that seems problematic and left out material that seems so important to anyone who was following the life of Jesus? So those are a couple of reasons why people have raised questions about the Griesbach hypothesis.
Yeah, and those are basically the same issues I have with it. I mean, imagine that you're going to, put together a gospel, even a shortened gospel, even let's say you want to do a Reader's Digest version of the gospels. Let's say you have Matthew and Luke and you're Mark and you want to create a kind of shorter, more succinct gospel narrative, and you're deciding what goes in and what goes out. Are you really going to leave out the Christmas stories, the birth narrative that establishes who Jesus is from the beginning? Is that really something that are you really going to leave out, as you said, Ross, the Lord's Prayer? Is that something that you're going to think is not worth putting into the text? It also, all of the things that we said when we discussed last time, all the things we said about the literary art of Mark's gospel as an oral or a spoken gospel that's been written down, you would lose all of that. Mark wouldn't be the great kind of storyteller that we described last time. Instead, he's perhaps a really good editor, but that's it. All of the little things that we pointed out in terms of the Mark and sandwich, the intercalation, then he either kind of edited that, or that just kind of happened by happenstance. So it kind of diminishes Mark's role as this great storyteller. I mean, at the most, like I said, he just becomes a very good editor. But I think another thing that makes it really hard to accept is if you just look at Mark and you look at where Mark begins and where Mark originally ended. Remember, Mark ends at Mark 16, chapter 16, verse 8. You see that structure. I mean, almost all of Mark shows up in Matthew and Luke, and especially in Luke. Luke contains almost the entirety of Mark. The places where the agreement in narrative breaks down are precisely where Mark doesn't have something. So Mark doesn't have a Christmas story. And so Matthew and Luke tell two very different Christmas stories. Now, that doesn't mean they don't agree on certain things. They agree that Jesus was born of a virgin, born in Bethlehem, that his parents were Mary and Joseph, all things that clearly go deep in the tradition, go back to the time of Jesus himself. But the actual narratives that they tell about the, you know, in terms of the Christmas story, and I've talked about this in other adult Sunday schools, highlight totally different things. They have different narratives of the Christmas story. Matthew, of course, with King Herod and the Magi, and Joseph being visited and by an angel in a dream, and the slaughter of the innocents, none of which is in Luke. Luke tells a story about Mary being visited by an angel and visiting her cousins, Zechariah and Elizabeth, and the birth of John the Baptist, and Mary and Joseph traveling from Nazareth to Bethlehem, and the shepherds in the fields seeing the heavenly host, and then going to be there for the birth of the child. And so very different stories, and it's precisely where Mark isn't providing a narrative frame for them. Similarly, when you get to the end, Mark 16:8, after that point, Matthew and Luke follow Mark up to Mark 16:8, and then their resurrection stories of Jesus are very different. They tell different narratives about Jesus after he was raised and what he did. Matthew putting much more emphasis on the risen Jesus meeting the disciples in Galilee, Luke staying in Jerusalem, fixating on the temple in Jerusalem, and having, for example, the story of the road to Emmaus, which isn't in Matthew. So in other words, you see a very close reliance on Mark for narrative structure, and when Mark doesn't provide a narrative, that's when you see Matthew and Luke tell very different stories. Ross, any last thoughts on Griesbach before we kind of leave that aside and start looking at Mark and priority?
One just footnote, which is to point out that Griesbach advanced his hypothesis in 1789, 1790, but then the shift to Mark and priority kind of dominated the field in modern scholarship. But in 1960, a man named F.F. Farmer essentially renovated the Griesbach hypothesis or had a slight variation on it. And so there's been, in my lifetime, a kind of resurgence of scholarly interest in Matthean priority. It's still the minority scholarly view, but yeah, there we are. Some books, you want to say something about those?
I was just, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but just these are 20th century books that are arguing for the Griesbach hypothesis. This one, The Gospel of Jesus, The Pastoral Relevance of the Synoptic Problem by William Farmer, who you were just mentioning, and then Sherman Johnson's The Griesbach Hypothesis and Redaction Criticism. So,
yeah, thanks for holding the book. I think I said Farmer's initials wrong. Yes, William Farmer. So just to point out that these there are conferences and debates and monographs and scholarly articles, and people still are wrestling with the question of which of these, whether the Griesbach hypothesis is in fact viable.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for mentioning that. So, that's something I didn't realize, was that Griesbach was actually not 19th century, but as far back as 18th century, making that argument. So as you say, by the 19th century, into the 19th century, and certainly by the end of it and into the 20th century, the consensus was Mark and priority, which is just to say that the gospel of Mark was written first, and that there's some kind of dependence upon Mark by Matthew and Luke. And once you accept that hypothesis of Mark and priority, that Mark was written first, which I think Ross, you and I probably would agree that that's the most likely scenario. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So once you accept that, you still have, you haven't gotten out of the synoptic problem yet, because even if you accept that Matthew and Luke have both used Mark for their narrative structure, that they've taken whole chunks of Mark, even word for word in the Greek, and transported it into their gospels, that doesn't explain all of the all of the shared content between Matthew and Luke. In other words, there's still teachings of Jesus, things, mostly teachings, but things Jesus did, things Jesus said, that Matthew and Luke agree on. And in some cases, with that same degree of, what's the word I'm looking for? It's still, in some cases, word for word, the same Greek vocabulary, the same grammar, the same syntax, but it's not in Mark. So then the synoptic problem, even if you accept Mark in priority, takes on a new element to it, which is, how do you explain the shared material between Matthew and Luke that's not in Mark? And I think maybe we'll take a look next at the Ferrer-Goulder hypothesis. And actually, I'm going to take this opportunity, Ross, to ask you, Austin Ferrer's name, am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, that's how I've heard it pronounced, yeah.
Okay. I've heard some other folks pronounce it slightly differently, and I've always wondered, am I pronouncing it right? But I'll trust you. So Austin Ferrer.
Yeah, the fellow, the theology guy at Sewanee, who's done did his thesis on Ferrer. I asked him how to pronounce it, and he said Ferrer. So
okay, good. Yeah, that's Rob McSwain.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
Rob was my advisor on my STM thesis, so I should have asked him then, like you did, but I didn't think to. And now he's probably, if he ever stumbles across this video, he's going to be disappointed that one of his former students wasn't sure how to pronounce Austin.
he'll be pleased that you mentioned him.
That's right. So let's talk about the Ferrer-Goulder hypothesis, again named after some scholars who put forward this hypothesis. Austin Ferrer and Michael Goulder, both of whom were 20th century scholars. Ferrer really more known for his Christian philosophy and theology than for New Testament studies. But Michael Goulder, most definitely a New Testament scholar. And did you want to say something about the Ferrer-Goulder hypothesis?
Yeah, I think I might let you take this one. Is this where we're going to talk about Q?
So this is the Mark in priority, but without Q.
Yeah, I'm gonna let you take the lead on this one.
All right, let me. I'm gonna pull up the share screen again, then really quick. And we'll take a look and see. That's not the one we want. This is the one we want. So. The Ferrer-Goulder hypothesis is a way of explaining, we're going to talk about Q. For right now, let me just use the word and think of it like in an algebraic equation where you have X, and you talk about X even though you don't know what X is, right? That's what Q is for us. It's a part of an equation, but we don't know what exactly it is. And that's actually a good way of thinking about it, but we're going to set it aside for a second. What if you wanted to do the equation without having to posit an unknown like Q? Well, Austin Ferrer suggested, and Michael Goulder picked up and argued for this hypothesis that begins with Mark in priority, which is where the consensus of scholarship is, but suggests that Matthew and Luke both used Mark, but that Matthew used Mark first, and then Luke used both Mark and Matthew. So in this way, you get Mark in priority. Mark provides a narrative structure of Matthew and Luke. You see all the reasons why Matthew and Luke share so much with Mark. They have incorporated Mark into their Gospels. But instead of positing any other source, any other unknown source, this simply says that Matthew got a hold of Mark first and added to Mark a whole lot of material that Matthew just kind of knew either through oral tradition or some other kind of source known only to Matthew, and that Luke then had in front of him both Mark and Matthew when he wrote his gospel, and that's why he has things in common with both Mark and Matthew, and why he has things in common with Matthew, but not Mark. And this would be, for example, some of the things that Ross has already mentioned, like the Sermon on the Mount, Sermon on the Plain, or the Lord's Prayer, which are in Matthew and in Luke, but not in Mark. And so the answer to why is because Luke had a copy of Matthew in front of him and took apart, for example, some of the constructions that we see, for example, the Sermon on the Mount, which in Matthew is a major block of teaching that covers several chapters. In Luke, the Sermon on the Plain is much shorter, and many of the pieces that make up the block of teaching that's known as the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew have been spread throughout the Gospel of Luke. A core of it's been preserved in the Sermon on the Plain, but other pieces have been spread throughout in this hypothesis. So Luke had Matthew's gospel in front of him, said, I don't want a big, long sermon that takes up several chapters. I'll take the core of it and put it in my chapter 6, and then I'll spread some of the other teachings that are in the Sermon on the Mount throughout my gospel text. So that's the Farragolder hypothesis. And it's really a way of, you might say, applying Occam's razor to kind of cut out anything that, any kind of unknown that we would have to posit to explain this, and try and explain it with just the texts we have at hand, this kind of relationship. And of course, Luke had his own sources along with this that he drew on that are unique to Luke alone. For example, the parable of the prodigal son shows up only in Luke. That would be something that Luke had on his own. There's one other reason for supporting the Farragolder hypothesis, and that is it seems perhaps to explain some of Papias's statements that we mentioned in our last video, Papias being a church leader, church teacher in the second century, who talked about the relationship of the texts. And he said that originally Matthew's gospel was a list of logoi, or sayings of Jesus, and that it later got expanded. And this might be a way of, you might say, well, that is perhaps what Matthew had before he got a hold of Mark, and then he put his logoi into Mark, and then you had, you got what we now call the gospel according to Matthew, and Luke just used that to write his own gospel. And so it might be a way of explaining the tradition that Papias is repeating in the second century, maybe. It still takes a little bit of stretching. Papias doesn't quite fit any model that that we actually now think is the way that things probably went. But Ross, are you familiar with the Farragut-Goddard hypothesis?
No, I'm you're teaching me something new tonight. I was not aware of this, but it's a you know, getting back to Occam's razor, where you know the idea is that Occam's razor suggests that the hypothesis that is the simplest and has recourse to the fewest unknowns, as it were, X factors, is the best. I mean, it's a way of arguing, and it's a very elegant solution. I must say, I'm quite taken with it.
I might have just converted Ross to Farragut-Goddard hypothesis. Well, interestingly enough, we mentioned last week in our last video, John A.T. Robinson, who of course was so controversial with his book Honest to God, but also took a very unexpectedly, we might say, conservative stand on the dating of the New Testament text. And then in our conversation, our Zoom conversation on Wednesday, bringing up John A.T. Robinson also led us to mention a bishop in the American Episcopal Church who saw himself as a kind of continuing the work that Robinson had started. And that's the retired Bishop of Newark, John Shelby Spong, Jack Spong. A lot of people, I think, unless they've actually read his Spong's books, for example, Seeing the Gospels Through Jewish Eyes, might not realize this, but Spong rejects the two-source hypothesis, which we're about to talk about, and the Q Gospel, in favor of the Farragut-Goddard hypothesis. He finds that one more convincing. And so oftentimes people think, oh, the Q Gospel, that's something that that only those, you know, wacky liberal New Testament, you know, scholars are into. And then they find out somebody like Spong has rejected Q and in favor of Farragut-Goddard. But I've actually known a lot of people, more theologians, I think, than New Testament scholars who have been attracted to the Farragut-Goddard hypothesis. And I think because of that that law of parsimony, that Occam's razor, you know, it really does kind of cut out something that we don't know for sure about. And maybe we should go ahead and talk about the unknown now. So let's move on from Farragut-Goddard. I think, you know, in talking about the two source hypothesis, what we'll really be able to do is explain why Farragut-Goddard might, what some of the problems with Farragut-Goddard, with that hypothesis are. Why even though it's attractive in some ways, it might not be the best for dealing with the material at hand. So why don't you introduce the two-source hypothesis?
So just to reiterate what we said before, assuming Mark was written first, Matthew and Luke both have material that is not in Mark. Matthew and Luke each have material that's unique to their own gospels. They each have their own birth narrative, for example, as Nick pointed out. But they have significant amount of overlapping material that Matthew and Luke share, but they didn't get from Mark. And because there's so much verbal agreement in this material, and it's, a lot of it is sayings of Jesus' teachings, scholars have come to the conclusion that there must have been a document or a source, which we no longer have, but which Matthew and Luke had. And it's referred to as Q because it's from the German word Quelle, or source. It's also sometimes referred to as the sayings source because the material that Matthew and Luke share with all this overlap tends to be Jesus' words. Nick is going to tell you in a few minutes about some attempts to reconstruct the document Q. The scholars that I read in preparation for this series emphasized that Q is a scholarly hypothesis rather than an actual document. In other words, no one has found a document called Q with all this material. It's a way of trying to make sense of how Matthew and Luke have this overlapping or shared material. And I'll let Nick talk to you a little bit about some attempts to reconstruct Q. But yeah, you can see from this diagram, you got Mark first, who's the source for Matthew and Luke, but then Q is also the source for Matthew and Luke. And that would explain, or at least so the hypothesis goes, why we have these this sayings material, words of Jesus that appear in Matthew and Luke, if not word for word the same, you know, very similar, and material which does not appear in Mark.
Yeah, so we have here up on the screen, Mark and Q, and you see Mark is both used by Matthew and used by Luke, and then Q is used both by Luke and by Matthew, roughly around the same time. So one of the questions is this really a better hypothesis than the Ferragulder hypothesis? And we could have endless debates about that. Certainly, Ross and I are not going to settle that dispute here on this video. I have long been convinced that the two source hypothesis makes the most sense, even though it does have to posit an extra source that has never actually been found. You know, there's no Q document that's in a museum somewhere or anything like that. Not even a fragment of the supposed Q source or Q saying source. I keep calling it Q gospel because some of the books that I have call it that. It really isn't a gospel, though, if we think of a gospel as narrating the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, as telling us the good news of God in Christ by way of his life, death, and resurrection. Q doesn't give us a narrative, if there is a Q, of the life of Jesus. The reason why I say that is because if Q did provide a narrative like that, then Matthew and Luke would have had to, or there would be some kind of evidence that Matthew and Luke, they wouldn't have had to, but there would probably be some kind of evidence that Matthew and Luke had tried to make the narrative of Q match up with or somehow interact with the narrative structure of Mark. And there's just no evidence of that. Instead, what we see are, again, mostly sayings of Jesus, which show up as parables and as aphorisms, as these logoi or sayings or kreia, pronouncement stories, kreiai. And so that's the assumption, is that this was a list. And we talked about lists as an early move that's made from oral culture to written culture. One of the basic things that you see in the most basic literate functionality in a mostly oral culture is the making of lists. And that's essentially what folks have said that Q is a list of the sayings of Jesus. Now, why is this a possibly better hypothesis than Ferragulder? Well, one reason is similar to the Griesbach. You have to imagine, if you want to go with the Ferragulder hypothesis, you have to imagine that Luke looked at a beautiful construction of Jesus's sayings like the gospel or like the Sermon on the Mount and said, I think I can do this better. and then broke it up and just sprinkled those sayings throughout his gospel, rather than keeping them together in this kind of stylistically beautiful and orally persuasive sermon that Matthew has crafted out of those sayings in the Sermon on the Mount. So that's one of the reasons why you might say the Farragulder hypothesis is less convincing. It also is going to push back the dating of Luke. You have to give enough time for Mark to be written, copied, spread around, so that Matthew gets a hold of it. Matthew to write his gospel, for it to be copied and spread around. And then finally, for Luke to be able to get a copy of both Mark and Matthew to write his own gospel. This would push, currently, we think Matthew and Luke were probably written around the same time in the 80s of the first century. But this would push Luke much later. If Matthew were written in the 80s, you have to give enough time for Luke to get a hold of a copy of it. Luke might not have been written until the turn of the century. So it would make Luke particularly late. Also, if we can bring Papias back in, perhaps he just got his names mixed up, and the list of sayings that he says was the original Gospel of Matthew, the list of logoi or sayings of Jesus, perhaps that's a reference to Q. We don't know, of course, that's speculation, but that's a possibility. Well, there are more technical reasons for why folks have argued for the two-source hypothesis, and I don't want to get into those. I do want to mention that a current defender, and I think the Farragulder hypothesis has far more defenders than the Griesbach hypothesis. A current defender of it is Mark Goodacre, who's a New Testament scholar. Is he at Duke? I think I can't remember. Maybe this says, no, this doesn't say, because it was from, I think he's in North Carolina at least. but he has a book called The Case Against Q, and he holds up the Farragulder hypothesis. But the majority of scholars have been convinced by looking at the texts laying next to each other and looking at the Greek and the details of that, that the two-source hypothesis is a better explanation. We don't have to resolve that tonight. I'm convinced that at least for now, that seems to make the most sense. One of the arguments against the two-source hypothesis was that this was an argument leveled out because it's been around for a while. For example, I don't know who first, I can't remember who first argued for the two-source hypothesis in Q, but I do know that Adolf von Harnack, who was an important scholar of New Testament and early Christianity and Christian theology in Germany in the early part of the 20th century, made arguments for the two-source hypothesis and for Q. So it's been around for quite some time. In those early days, one of the things that was said was, if this is real, it's not just that we don't have a copy of Q, but we don't have anything like this from early Christian literature. There's no example of, just besides Papias's mention of that, there's no example of a list of the sayings of Jesus that just begin, Jesus said this, Jesus said that, you know, in a list like that. And at the time, that was a pretty devastating critique. And then in the 1940s, I think it was 1945, actually, the Nag Hammadi Library was found, a collection of texts that we may talk about at a later time, many of which are known now kind of perhaps under the unhelpful and unwieldy title of Gnostic Gospels and Gnostic texts, but a whole treasure trove of ancient Christian documents that are not part of the Bible were found in Nag Hammadi, Egypt in 1945. And among them was a gospel known as the Gospel of Thomas. And essentially the Gospel of Thomas is just a list of Jesus's sayings. So it's exactly the type of document that Q would be. It's not Q. Its list of sayings is different than what we find in Matthew and Luke. But it is a list of sayings attributed to Jesus in the style that scholars thought that Q would be found in. I can say a little bit more, and I will say a little bit more about attempts to reconstruct Q and perhaps the community that created Q, but I wanted to take a minute and just kind of get your reaction to all this, Ross.
Well, one point I wanted to make for anyone who has been stuck with us so far in this presentation is, if you're wondering why bother with all this if it's so inconclusive, I would say this, that paying attention to the differences and the similarities among the Gospels really is helpful for us as Bible readers. For example, once you begin to pay attention to similarities and differences among the synoptics, you notice that Luke has a particular interest in the Holy Spirit, for example, and he has material that's not found in Mark or not found in Matthew, where the Holy Spirit features prominently. For example, his birth narrative, Luke's birth narrative, it's full of references to the Holy Spirit. The Zechariah and Elizabeth and Mary and, you know, all the events that took place before the birth of Jesus or leading up to the birth of Jesus, it's full of references to the Holy Spirit. So Luke has a real interest in the Holy Spirit. Luke is also very interested in issues of poverty and people on the margins. It's not that that doesn't appear in Matthew and Mark, but Luke has a particular angle. So if you're wondering, you know, why are we spending all this time on these hypotheses if there's so much that remains inconclusive, it's that even if you never figure out exactly which is the correct hypothesis, it tunes you in. It sort of gets you paying attention to nuances and differences and features of each gospel so that we can hear each of them in his own particular terms.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, it can seem like all of this just begs the big so what question, you know, why does this matter? And in some sense, you know, which hypothesis best describes the transmission of the, you know, the relationship of the text and the transmission of the tradition. That doesn't, for example, inform my Sunday morning preaching very often. You know, that's not a big thing, but I think that what you're saying is actually very, very true and very important. I mean, the church in some sense kind of ignored the Gospel of Mark for centuries. Because why do you need Mark when you've got all the same stories in Matthew and Luke? And it's in part because of the scholarly consensus around Mark and priority that led scholars to then read Mark on its own terms to see what Mark is doing. And then that, you know, all of the things that we mentioned in the last video about you know, the, you know, incredible ways that Mark writes as a storyteller became apparent and relatively recently because of this kind of focus. And then, as you say, that allows Luke to stand apart and be read for the special contribution that Luke's gospel brings to the New Testament. And when we talk about Matthew and the ways that Matthew presents Jesus as a prophet like Moses, and, you know, it helps us to see those things also. So I think that's a really good point. I do want to spend a little bit more time on Q, and then we need to maybe change gears and talk about the Didache, because we did promise we'd get to that also. since the two-source hypothesis that Matthew and Luke use independent of one another, Mark and Q, and we don't quite know what Q is, but we use Q to fill out the sayings, the teachings of Jesus that are, you know, largely missing from Mark's gospel. Mark doesn't spend a whole lot of time presenting Jesus as a teacher, and we talked about that. After that became the consensus, well, you know, grad students are always looking for new things to write dissertations about, and more scholars started to focus on the Q gospel or the Q saying source, and to try and understand and perhaps even reconstruct what it might have been like, what it might have looked like. And of course, with the way that they did that was to simply take Matthew and Luke and strip away everything that's clearly from Mark, and then look at what's left that Matthew and Luke have significant agreement on, not just slight agreement on, but significant linguistic agreement on. And then to kind of separate those things out. And again, it's a list of Jesus's sayings or Jesus's teachings. And this has become the nucleus of multiple different reconstructions of what the Q gospel or the Q saying source would have been like. This has taken many different forms, and actually set up here behind me, most of these books back here are books I have, and these aren't all the books I have, but most of these are books I have on Q, attempts to reconstruct Q, or once that's been done, historically reconstruct the community of Q. Who made this list of Jesus's sayings, and what might they have been like? Well, that might seem to be getting super speculative to you, and I agree, it is somewhat speculative, but there have been some folks, John Kloppenburg, for example, is a scholar who's basically built his entire career as a New Testament scholar on Q. And so some of the books out here are from him, including this one, Excavating Q, the History and Setting of the Saying Gospel. Now remember, this is a text that's supposed to be shorter than Mark's gospel, which is the shortest of all the gospels. This is just a short, if we ever find it, if it exists and we ever find it, it's not going to take up a whole lot of space. But as you can see, John Kloppenburg feels like he can write quite a bit about the reconstruction of the Q saying source and the people who first wrote it down. And that's only one of his books that I have back here. He was part of a project of put together by New Testament scholars, included him and another one named James Robinson, who is a really important 20th century New Testament scholar, known as the International Q Project, where they tried to come together and reconstruct the Q gospel. Or the Q saying source, and they published in 2000 what's known as the critical edition of Q. Remember, this is short. It's shorter than, let's just get a comparison here. Here is Mark's gospel in my Bible. You see, it's not a whole lot of the Bible. Q is shorter than this, if it exists. But the International Q Project has published their critical edition of Q. And as you can see, it's a pretty massive tome here. Now, there's a lot of white space in it, I have to tell you. Let me just kind of give you, and I don't know how well this is showing up on the screen.
I can see that clearly. Yeah, that's good.
Very good. So you see, it's got the parallels of Matthew and Luke and Mark, and then with the reconstruction here, what the reconstruction of Q is. This is in the Greek, and then below it is, depending on which page you're looking at, the English translation. And for example, in this case, here's a place where the Q has an equivalent in the Gospel of Thomas, which was written both in Greek and in Coptic. So it's got a little bit of the Coptic in there. But it's pretty incredible to me that people take this hypothetical source so seriously that that they spend careers working on trying to reconstruct it and reconstruct the community that that might have used it. You might ask yourself, what happened then? Why don't we still have it? If it's true, if it's real, you know, why don't we have it around anymore? And the easy answer to that is just that it. What's the point of a list of Jesus's sayings if they've been entirely incorporated into two gospels? Remember, copying is an expensive and time-consuming and laborious process. And if you're already copying the same teachings in Matthew and Luke, why copy them in a separate text? And of course, papyrus and even vellum is not the kind of material that typically lasts through the centuries. So when ancient books like the Nag Hammadi Library or the Dead Sea Scrolls are found, it's because they were stored in a very unique setting, both geographically and temperately, but also in jars meant to preserve these texts. If that didn't happen for a text, it would easily disappear into history, which is what most scholars think happened with the Q saying source. I think that might be enough to say about that before we move on to the Didache, unless you had anything that you wanted to add.
Nope, I think that's a great summary. Thank you.
All right. Well, why don't you go ahead and launch us off, because I feel like I've been talking for a while now.
I'll let Nick talk to you a little bit about why we decided to include the Didache in this presentation, but I'll say just a little bit about what it is and give you a little bit of a flavor for it. The word Didache means teaching, and it refers to a document whose full title is The Teaching of the 12 Apostles, commonly called the Didache. It consists of two parts. The first is a code of Christian morals, often referred to as the two ways. So the way of righteousness and the way of wickedness, the way of life, the way of death. And the second part is a manual of church order. And by that, I mean, it describes how worship is to be done. There's a description of baptisms and the type of water to use for baptism. There's a lengthy description of the types of qualities that are looked for bishops and overseers. There are some fascinating references to false teachers and how to tell the difference between a false prophet and a true prophet, hospitality. It's a whole range of how to conduct life in the church. The date of the Didache is difficult to determine, partially because these two parts come from different provenances. They seem to be dated differently, but the one possible theory of composition is that around 150, an editor in Alexandria took sources, these materials from the two ways, which might have originated in Alexandria, and the material on the church order, which might have come from rural churches in Syria, and combined them into a single document, which this editor then attributed to the apostles. It's a fascinating document in part because it shows us the church as it's making the transition from the apostolic period, the life of the apostles, to what's often referred to as the post-apostolic period. And even though it was written in 150, which is obviously significantly later than the death of the older apostles, it gives us a picture of life in the church chronologically earlier. And so it's a really interesting picture of life in the New Testament community or the Christian community as it was making the transition from its very earliest forms to a type of church life that required more organization and more structure, more details about how the life of the church was to be organized. It also is interesting to us because it reveals a little bit of how the canon was developed. Let me just file this by title because it gets a bit more detailed than maybe we want to get into. But it has a sort of liberal approach to the canon, we might say, in that the Didachist, the editor, includes a lot of material from the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke. A lot of it reads like bits of the Sermon on the Mount. But he also incorporates material from documents that were not included in our canon. So it's this interesting example of the kind of porous boundaries that existed before the canon was formed fully. And so for that reason, it's another example of how the New Testament came into being. As you read the Didache, you get some insights into the various documents that were being considered as possibly canonical. There's some fascinating snapshots of worship in the early church. There's a Eucharistic prayer, which is really beautiful, which if we have time, we might refer to. So that's just a little bit of background to the Didache and why we thought it was worth introducing to you. Nick?
Yeah, so it's something that's easy to find on the internet. So I encourage you to find it. It's a short read also. It's not very long. So I encourage all of y'all who are watching or listening to find it. And I may try and put a link in here if I have a chance to a place where you can, I think you can both find it to read. And I think on YouTube, there are places where you can find someone reading it. So you can actually hear it read if that's what you prefer. And it's not long, it's shorter than this video is going to end up being actually. As Ross was saying, it's kind of a manual on Christian life and prayer. And so for this reason, I like to refer to it as the first book of common prayer. Because it, in a sense, it operated in that way for the community that used it, or the communities that used it. Its list, when Ross mentioned the two ways, I want to say something about this really quick. Two-way, that's a kind of jargony term that's used sometimes. You see this type of literature show up within the Bible and outside of the Bible and in the ancient world, where there's a list of things you should do and a list of things you shouldn't do. And one is said to lead to life and the other one said to lead to death. So we see this famously in the Torah or the Pentateuch. Moses lays before the people of Israel two ways, and one is the way of life and one is the way of death. We see it in ancient Jewish wisdom literature and other wisdom literature, and we see it in the Didache. There's these two ways. There's a list of things Christians should be doing and a list of things that they shouldn't be doing. And one leads to life and one leads to death, as they say. Although there's an interesting unique perspective taken by the Didache when it gets to the end of its list for the way of life, which is, as Ross said, very similar to the list of Jesus's sayings in the Sermon on the Mount. So some have suggested a connection either between the Didache and Matthew's gospel or the Didache and the Q sayings source. And I'm going to come back to that a little bit later. But when it gets to the end of this list of sayings that are the way of life, how you should be, and it says, if you want to be perfect, this is what you do. The way of life is how to be perfect. And it comes to the end of it, and it says, but if you can't do all of these things, do what you can. And that's not something that typically you hear in wisdom literature. Usually it's pretty dualistic. If you don't do these things, then you're not going to be perfect and you're not going to live the way of life. But the Didache offers a little bit of grace. Do what you can, which I think is pretty wonderful. And then it does have rites for baptism and rites for Holy Eucharist. And here, even in the rites for baptism, we begin to see some of that do what you can mentality. So the Didache says, look, if there's going to be a baptism, the best way for it to be done is in full immersion in cold running water. Living water, running water. But if you can't work that out, then still water is okay. It should still be cold and there should still be immersion, but still water is okay. But if you can't find cold still water, the warm still water, that'll do too. And if you can't do full immersion, then at least have some of the water poured over top of them. That's okay also. And in other words, there's that do what you can mentality throughout it. Here's the best way to do it, but here's what's acceptable. And I think that's a wonderful testimony to grace in the life of this community of Christians, especially when you think about the fights in the 16th and 17th century between the Roman Catholics and the magisterial reformers and the Anabaptists over questions of when do you baptize and what should baptism involve and should it be immersion, and people were fighting over this and people were being physically hurt over their answers to these questions. But the Didache says, well, do what you can. And it also has a Eucharistic prayer. But here, again, we see something interesting. There's a Eucharistic prayer, and Ross may talk a little bit more about this, but it's not like the Eucharistic prayer that we see in 1 Corinthians that draws on the tradition of Jesus' Last Supper. There's no mention of Jesus' crucifixion. There's no mention of the bread and the wine being the body and blood of Christ. So we get a different kind of Eucharistic prayer in this early document. And some scholars have suggested that we actually see two different Eucharistic prayers put together, an earlier Eucharistic prayer in chapter 10 of the Didache, and then a later, more developed Eucharistic prayer in chapter 9 of the Didache. And again, Ross may want to come back to this. So the final thing I want to mention about it is it spends some time talking about a group known as the prophets. These wandering, you might call them even charismatic Christian leaders who brought the word of the gospel to settled communities. And it's a little bit wary of these folks. It accepts them as authorities and leaders, but it provides a whole kind of litmus test of how do you tell a real prophet from a false prophet? And I'm going to come back to that in a minute. I want to hand it back over to Ross for a second, but I'm going to come back to these questions about prophets and their relationship. But I did want to say one last thing in connection to the Eucharistic prayer. one of the things that they say is, here's the Eucharistic prayer that we use. And it's just like, you know, we turn in our Book of Common Prayer and, all right, we've got right one Eucharistic prayer, right two Eucharistic prayer. Is it A or B or C or D? Well, they've got, you know, chapter 9 Eucharistic prayer or chapter 10 Eucharistic prayer. But then they say, when the prophet comes into the community, the wandering prophet comes, at that time, let him pray the Eucharistic prayer in whatever way that he's led by the Spirit to pray it, which I think is really fascinating. But I want to turn it over to Ross before I get into any of that.
Thanks. Yeah, I think my contribution for the Didache would simply be to let you hear a little bit of it. And so I'm going to pull up my screen share, and I'll make this available as a document for you to look at. This is an English translation of the Didache, and I put at the top where you can find this link so you can read it on your own. And in fact, I'll just scroll through and show you a few things. Under the two ways, there's a section on the first commandment, loving God and loving your neighbor as yourself. It's expanded a bit, but you'll see this part sounds a lot like the Sermon on the Mount. Love those who hate you. You shall not have an enemy. Abstain from fleshly and worldly lusts. If someone strikes you in your right cheek, turn to him the other also, and you shall be perfect. There's some interesting specific moral injunctions. Other sins forbidden in chapter 3, be neither a filthy talker nor of lofty eye, for out of these adulteries are engendered. So there's a concern for speech or language. There's also a concern about not being a murmurer, not being a complainer. Be not a murmurer or grumbler, since it leads to the way of blasphemy. There's some material about divisions and schisms. The church is enjoined against them. There's some interesting material about raising children in the knowledge and love of the Lord. Do not remove your hand from your son or daughter, rather teach them the fear of God from their youth. Let me just scroll down. This is the section that Nick was talking about earlier about baptism. Baptize in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit in living water. But if you have no living water, baptize in other water. If you can't do that, do so in warm. And if you don't have either, pour water three times on the head. So Episcopalians really, you know, have a place to stand when we read this, our practice of sprinkling. Here's the Lord's Prayer, which is included. This is the a little bit of the material of the Eucharistic prayers that Nick was referring to. When the breaking of the bread is done, we thank thee, our Father, for the life and knowledge which you have made known to us through Jesus, thy servant. To thee be glory forever. Even this broken bread was scattered over the hills and gathered together and become one. So let thy church be gathered together from the ends of the earth. So there's an emphasis on the joy of the community gathered together at the table. And there is also an the prayer after communion, some similar emphasis on the joy of God's presence through creation and of the hope that we have for Christ's return. And it's a little bit different emphasis than entered the church not too long after this, where the death of Christ and the atonement of Christ's death for our sins was moved to the center of the Eucharistic theology. And in my own lifetime, I can remember when the prayer book that we now use, 1976, was being adopted. There was often, the point was often made that the 1928 prayer book reflected the older Eucharistic emphasis, which was pretty exclusively on Christ's sacrificial death, whereas in the current prayer book, there was an attempt to recapture some of this earlier emphasis on the fellowship meal and the joy of gathering in expectation of Christ's return. So you can read through those prayers on your own and see if you think it reflects that. Here's our section on the prophet speaking in the spirit that Nick was referring to. I love this. There's a whole section about how to show hospitality and how not to be jerked around by somebody who's just a loafer and wants to not do any work. If a wayfarer comes, assist him as far as you can, but he shall not remain with you more than 2 or 3 days, if need be. But if he wants to stay with you and is an artisan, let him work and eat. But if he has no trade, according to your understanding, see to it that as a Christian, he shall not live with you idle. But if he wills not to do, he is a Christmonger. Watch that you keep away from such. And there's another translation puts this, if the person has a trade, let him engage in a trade so that he can eat, but don't let him trade on Christ. In other words, use Christ as an excuse for coming into the community. So there's just a little bit of a flavor of the Didache, and I'll post this, or we'll make this available for you to read at your leisure. There are a number of different translations, but this one you can find at earlychristianwritings.com.
That's great. So, in looking through that that text, when we see the focus on living out the Christian life with the two ways, and then the movement into the two, what we would call sacraments or mysteries of the church, baptism and Eucharist, and how to do these things. And you'll notice that they're tied very closely together, just as they are in our current prayer book. Our prayer book was inspired not just by the Didache, but some other early Christian liturgical texts that really tied closely baptism and Eucharist. And I don't know if y'all noticed as Ross was scrolling down, but one of the things that it says is that no one should partake of the Eucharist until they've been baptized. And we see that in this very, very early liturgical text of the church, because the two go hand in hand. And then it moves into this discussion of the prophets. I want to put forward to you one perspective that I have found persuasive, and you may or may not, for how to understand both Q and the Didache, at least early sections, early portions of the Didache. As Ross pointed out, we may have several different written traditions that have been compiled there in the Didache, but in some of these early traditions, especially around the sacraments and around the wandering prophets, there was a book that came out, I believe, in the 70s by a New Testament scholar called Gerd Tyson, and it was Sociology of early Palestinian Christianity, or of Palestinian Christianity, something along those lines. And what Tyson picked up on was that there seems to be a lot of itinerancy in both the New Testament and some of these added or extra texts beyond the New Testament, like the Didache. We see Jesus is constantly traveling from place to place. And there's a scene early in Mark's gospel where Jesus comes to Capernaum, where he heals Peter's mother, and then many people start flocking to Jesus. And he heals them, and it seems like he's doing this all night long, and the disciples fall asleep, and then early in the morning before the sun's risen, they can't find him. Peter goes out to look for him, and Jesus says, it's time for us to go. We're not going to stay here. It's time for us to move on. The New Testament scholar, John Dominic Crossan, has said, at that moment you could probably just hear this kind of groan from Peter, because here he had the best possible situation. Set up Jesus in his own home. He would get all this honor from having this prophet who heals people stationed out of his own home. And he could make Capernaum his base, and it would bring honor to Peter and his family. And they could set up this nice little situation where people come to hear Jesus preach and teach and then get healed by him. And instead, Jesus says, no, that's not the way the kingdom comes. We've got to move on to the next town. Jesus is always moving around. The kingdom isn't located in one particular place. Something very similar to what Jesus says to the woman at the well in Samaria, you know, that you Samaritans worship God on Mount Gerizim and we Jews worship God on Mount Zion, but the time is coming and now is when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, because such the Father seeks to worship him. The Father is spirit himself. And so we see the kingdom of God's not going to be localized. So there's a lot of movement in the Gospels. Jesus is always moving, itinerancy. Paul in his letters is always going somewhere, and he's always telling you where he's been and where he's going next, or why he's not going anywhere because somebody's locked him up. So we see itinerancy just fill these texts, and we see it also in the Didache. We see that there are wandering prophets, as they say, who bring the gospel. They bring the word of God, but you know, you've got to be a little bit wary of them, because even by this early stage in the first century in Christianity, there are folks who have learned that you can take advantage of Christian charity. It happened from the very beginning. The translation Ross was reading called them Christ mongers, or I've also seen translations refer to them as the Christ hustlers. In Greek, they're the Christemporoi, you know, from the same word we get the word emporium from. They're the ones who trade on Christ, as opposed to the Christians. And the Didache has already recognized that there's folks like this. You have to be careful about them, and that's why it gives these different rules for how to figure out who's a real wandering prophet and who's just trying to get a free meal out of all this. What Crossan has suggested, based off of Ger Tyson's work, is that let me go back for a second. Tyson and those who have followed him in this perspective, and there are those who have argued against it, like Richard Horsley, and we don't need to get into that, but Tyson has kind of suggested that there was almost a two-tier kind of Christianity in this first century. There's the real Christians who have given up everything to follow Christ. They've taken on the itinerant and ascetic lifestyle, wandering around in this way, having no home. You know, foxes have dens and birds of the sky have nests, but the Son of Man and those who follow him have no place to lay their heads. And so they've followed Christ, they've given up everything, they're wandering around, they rely on the communities. These are the true Christians, the prophets. And then they're supported by a kind of second class who are interested in the message, but not ready to give up their peasant lifestyle or their retainer lifestyle and follow it. That's an oversimplification, maybe even a caricature of Tyson's position, but that there's something to that in Tyson's work. What Crossan has suggested is that's a misunderstanding. That in fact, it's really an interactive relationship between the itinerants and the householders who accept them. And he has suggested, John Dominic Crossan has, that the two texts that really reflect these two communities that come together and in their interaction are church, or in their interaction are in some way make present the kingdom of God, are the Q saying source and the Didache. The Q saying source is a list of the kinds of words, gospel, the sayings, the teachings that the wandering prophets would bring. And the Didache is the response of the communities that would welcome in these prophets and would invite them to pray the Eucharistic prayer in whatever way the Spirit moved them to, but also had to be careful that these were true prophets and had to discern which prophets were true prophets and which ones were just trying to take advantage of the community. And so I don't know if this is right or not. Obviously, it's historical reconstruction. It's built on a degree of speculation. But I find this a very attractive view of the first century church, particularly this would be in Galilee, in the northern Galilee and up into Syria. These communities of householders who would welcome in these wandering prophets. The wandering prophets would bring the teachings of Christ, the word of Christ, perhaps even in the spirit bring healing in the way that Christ brought healing. And these householders who are represented in the Didache, or at least in early versions of the Didache, would receive them and provide them with the food they need for the day. So, you know, the answer to the Lord's Prayer, give us this day our daily bread, give them their daily bread. They would break bread together in the Eucharist. And that in that interaction, the church became, the community became a kind of symbol of the kingdom of God being present in that time and in that place. So that, I just wanted to lift that up. Ross, any response to that or thoughts on that?
No, that's a fascinating thesis. I hadn't heard that before.
Yeah. And again, you know, ultimately there's, you know, these aren't the kinds of things that you can find a whole lot of hard evidence for. Historical reconstruction doesn't really work like that. So, you know, you deal with the texts and you try and figure out what they're saying and to whom they're saying it. And that's just one way of looking at it that I've particularly found very persuasive. So we've talked about a lot. We've talked about the synoptic problem. We've talked about the standard solution known as the two-source hypothesis, that Matthew and Luke are both dependent independently of one another. They are both dependent on the Gospel of Mark and the Q saying source. And we've talked about the Didache as an early Book of Common Prayer, in a sense, that may reflect a relationship between the communities that receive these wandering prophets represented by the teachings in the Q saying source. I think that's a lot for us to cover, and we may need to wrap it up now, but I want to, Ross, do you have any final words to say?
No, this has been a really stimulating conversation, and I appreciate all the work you've done on the Q material. I've learned some things I didn't know about Q tonight, and I just would encourage anyone who's interested in learning a bit more about the Didache to spend a little time reading it. It takes about 10, 15 minutes to read quickly, and I think you'll sense that you're plunged into this fascinating boundary period between what we know of as the New Testament and what happens later in the church. So it's a wonderful read.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you so much, Ross, and I look forward to talking with you and our parishioners from the Fort Church on Wednesday about these topics some more.
I am too.
All right, take care.
Thanks.